A little while ago, when Jeff and Vince asked me to pick a song and then talk about the song, I had a whole bunch of them that I was going to choose. And this is the one that I landed on. And the title of the song is What Do I Know? And this last week, a friend of mine was asking me what I'm talking about this today. And I said, well, the title's called What Do I Know? And he said, well, that'll be short. Thanks, Mark. So I'm going to apologize for this as I start, because one of the challenges of not talking a lot kind of communicating here very much is that I read a fair bit, and there's a lot of stuff going on in this brain. And so I'm going to try to pull all of that together. But I think preaching is a little like 10-pin bowling. So if you've ever been 10-pin bowling, you know that what you don't do is you don't throw it down the middle straight. Right? Because if you do that, chances of getting a strike are pretty slim. What you do is you spin it, and then it goes on the outside, and then it comes in at the end. Okay, you know what I mean? Now, that's what you hope happens. That's what preaching's like. So once in a while, you spin it, and it goes out, and then there's a thing called a gutter there. And so once in a while, it can be a gutter ball. So I'm hoping today is not a gutter ball, but I'm going to give this a good old heave-ho here. I really like this song because the trajectory of it goes from, you know, not getting involved to the last stanza. I'll paint the scene that we could, if we all come together, you know, we could all be free. And there's this trajectory from no engagement to this, we can change the world in a moment. You know, but what do I know? And I think that trajectory is very, very powerful. I want to start with a parable. Do you remember I don't know if you remember the troubles from from the 1960s when it's like two hands go up, from the IRA back in Northern Ireland and in the conflict back there, Bernadette Devlin and all that stuff. And, one of the tactics that the IRA had was, they would plant a bomb in a shopping center, and then they would phone the police, and they say they've got 5 minutes to get out, to clear the place. And so then there would be this scramble, and they would clear the place, and that was one of their tactics of being disruptive. And the story went around then that one of the IRA died and went to heaven. And he's standing at the gates of heaven, and Peter comes out with this big book. And he sees this IRA member at the gates, and he starts looking through this big book for the guy's name. He goes, sorry, buddy, but you're a member of the IRA. You're not in. And the member of the IRA goes, sorry, buddy, but you got this all wrong. You got 5 minutes to get out. And I think that Christianity is more about getting God out of heaven than getting us into heaven. Because oftentimes what we've done is we've reduced our faith to believe that God is a certain way rather than believing in God. And so what we've done is we've made it about having a certain set of beliefs that if we believe the right things, then maybe we'll make it in. But this is my thought, is that if we believe in God rather than that God, And we take that word belief and we restore it back to its fundamental meaning of kind of like the mid-15, 1600s, that it's about trust in, it's about connection to, it's about this connection, right? And what we've done is in response to the Enlightenment is we believed that the right things, because we didn't compete in the same way that scientists were. How they believed and what they proved, and we tried to align what we did with what they did. And it brought us into conflict, and so then we reduced belief down to believing the right things. And I think that part of what this song addresses is a couple of pieces that I've been struggling with that I don't think I'm alone in this, but I think part of it is this whole issue around the idea of certainty and satisfaction. And, you know, all of us want to know why we're here and where we're going. I mean, that's part of kind of how we're wired. But I think the gospel, when we start to boil it down and really get to the heart of the gospel, that rather than being certain, it's about being okay with our doubt, right? How could God reveal himself in such a way that would remove all elements of doubt, if you removed all elements of doubt, there'd be no room for me. Because to doubt is human, and that's part of our journey, and to be okay with that. Whereas I was raised when I went to college, and I went to a denominational college, which means you just have enough time to get indoctrinated, but not really educated. And so they wanted you to be really certain about what you believed. And so we were given all of these courses that they lined up so that you had a really nice systemic theology, as though you can reduce God down to some nice system. And, you know, God bless the Germans, but there's a lot of German theologians that, you know, their names are kind of branded in your brain at some level. And it really was about getting the stuff right. You see, because if they were going to release you in this particular movement on a community of people, they wanted to make sure that you were kind of towing the line, right? And so there was no room to ask a question that didn't fit. And yet I think the gospel is really about us being okay with what doesn't fit and being, maybe not being certain. So, you know, in a sense, what we need to have as a faith community, we need to have a non-membership course. Right? So people say, you remember a French church? Well, no, I got a non-membership card just to prove I'm not. Right? Because what we need is we need non-leaders. We need pastors that are willing not to lead. Right? Because what we do is we look to them to lead and go, no, it's about us taking responsibility. A good analyst doesn't analyze you. They get you to analyze you. Right? So good leadership says, no, I'm not leading. So, no, you're not a member. And we flip that and we go, oh, okay, so I have to take responsibility. That's exactly what Vince was saying. That if we get it, then we take full responsibility. And are you going to get it wrong? Of course you are. Because once you remove the need for certainty, it's okay not to be right. And by the way, you don't have to be wrong for me to be right. And all of a sudden, things start to shift for us so that now we believe in rather than believe that. And rather than being reductive, we can be expansive in terms of our faith and community. And I like that because I think that's what Ed Sheeran says in this song, what do I know? I mean, the other thing is that we have, and I like the little phrase there, in the last stanza where he said that I'm all for people living in their dreams, but there's more to life than fitting in your jeans. And I thought, you know, there's this sense in which we have become fascinated with satisfaction. We're addicted to it. We're driven by it. We need to be somehow satisfied. And so that pursuit of satisfaction, the media, the advertising industry, basically says to us, if you wore this particular pair of jeans, or if you won this lottery ticket, or if you did this particular thing, then you would be happy. Because most of us believe at some level that if I had more, then I'd be happy. I'd be content. Because the lack in my life is what creates that discontent. Now, the interesting piece around that is what we know from research is if you actually got what you wanted, you actually wouldn't be happy with that because you would find that that actually doesn't satisfy you. Because it's called the reality principle, and that reality, we need the reality principle, right? The pleasure principle says, I need this, I want to have this, but the reality principle says, you got to fight to get it. So, for example, if I took a plane right now, and took a couple of you up to the top of Mount Everest, and I put you on the top of Mount Everest with your phone, and you take a selfie, and you come back down, and I fly you back down, and you go to a kind of a nice dinner party, and you're showing people this selfie. How much meaning would that have? Absolutely none. Because the fact that you get to the top of Everest is irrelevant. You could Photoshop yourself in there if you wanted, right? The thing is, it's the struggle to train, to fight, to risk your life to get up and down again. That's the struggle. And it's the struggle in life that we need. We don't like it sometimes because sometimes that struggle is not nice. And that satisfaction piece says that if we recognize that we are addicted to it, and if we broke the addiction, now we'd just be free to be here and to be okay with where we are. That if you weren't looking for satisfaction, that you actually recognize that right now you're complete. Which I know goes against an awful lot of the teaching I grew up with, right? Because the teaching I grew up with, the way I saw Jesus, right, was that Jesus was going to be my Savior, and I definitely needed saving. And I needed saving from me. And I needed saving from my sin. And I needed saving from my brokenness, right? Well, I'm here to tell you that I'm still broken. And I'm okay with that. And when we get okay with the fact that we're broken, that frees us to be in this moment. Because now I'm not looking for something out there. I can be right here. So my need for certainty and my need for satisfaction or my addiction to those things, once that addiction is broken, and I think that's what Jesus does, is he frees us from that, then we can be present. Then I don't have to make people on the other side of the tracks wrong. You with me? So, because at that point, then you're able to embrace. So I was put into an interesting situation a while ago where we were running a retreat for First Nations. And their spirituality and mine are interesting. Okay, so I have no judgment about theirs or mine. It just is interesting. And we were invited to do a smudge as part of the beginning of our retreat, which in my traditional understanding of what that was and my Christianity and all that kind of stuff, certainly wouldn't have been able to get there and been okay with it. And I thought, you know what? I need to be okay with this. And it was a very interesting experience for me because it was really embracing other, right? It was embracing something that I was not used to, and it was certainly outside of my comfort zone. But once I got there, it was like it was so powerful because in this context now, it's like, boy, that's the roots of our country. That's before first contact. You know, before first contact, you had in the center of the village, you had the medicine in the center, and then you had the children, and then you had the life givers around that, and then you had the, you know, the knowledge keepers around that, and then you had the warriors around that, right? And so what we did at first contact is we just stole the medicine. And the trade-off was we gave them alcohol and we gave them disease. And now we look at them and go, there's something wrong with you. I'm going, wait a minute here. Are we part of this conversation? And so by entering into that, it was a very powerful piece for me of learning and recognizing that truth and reconciliation can bring us back together. That love and understanding and positivity, that it really does, it can change how we see the world, not only changing the world. And so that was just very, very powerful for me, experiencing that. The other thing I've been thinking a lot about is recently is this issue around how do we see brokenness, or how do we see ideas like addiction, like depression in our culture and in our world? And from a church religious perspective, as we look outside, how do we view others? And in a lot of the research that I've been doing, it's interesting because. Well, let me make a statement. The opposite of addiction is not sobriety. And when I read that recently, it really hit me. And I've been sober for a couple of minutes. And it's important to me that I'm sober, by the way, because if I'm not sober, that's not the best of who I am. So, you know, my sobriety is important. But the opposite of sobriety, the opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is connection. And when I saw that, it was like, oh my goodness, that we have become such a disconnected culture. About 15 years ago, they did a study and they asked, how many people could you call if you were in crisis? And the average number for people was 5. It was the most common response, was 5. Recently, they asked the same question to a number of people. And the most common response when they said, how many people could you call in a time of crisis? The most common response was 0. What has happened in our culture is we have lost connection and we've replaced the connection with addiction. And then we take a look at, and I'm going to jump into a really sensitive issue here. So don't email me after this, okay? But how we see depression, for example, is a very equally disturbing issue, right? So, and I know that there are many causes of depression that we have. There can be the chemistry in our brain. There's a very real piece on that. And on the Hamilton scale, you can actually move someone about 1.8 points with the right kind of medication, right? If you lose, or if there's a death in your family, it's like negative 6 points, right? So it can impact you. Trauma, childhood trauma, for example, can have a big impact on how we deal with our emotions and moods, etc. And so that's an important component of it. However, just giving someone medication and leaving them isolated doesn't always work. And so we become very dependent because the reason we're attracted to medication is because it's a quick fix. Give me a pill for that and I'm good. Right? Now, if you suffer from mental illness, I recognize that it is not that simple. And I know there's a lot of pain connected to it, and I have a lot of empathy with that. I've been there. I understand that. So I'm not trivializing, minimizing, or making something simple. My point is that, for example, in Japan, there was a gentleman who was depressed. And as an antidepressant, they gave him a cow. And they gave him the cow because then he could milk the cow and he could provide sustenance for the people of the village and he became a meaningful member of the community, right? I mean, think about this. 13% of us in this room love our jobs. 24% of us hate our jobs. The other 67% of us are kind of like, kind of sleepwalking through life. That's 84% of us that don't have a great relationship with the place we spend the most time. And the issue is not about the work, by the way. The issue is the power imbalance. That most of us feel disempowered when we're at work. There's an interesting story of a bike shop in Baltimore where some of the workers were there and they were really intrigued by it. They asked the question, what does that boss do? And we're fixing the bikes and like we're not sure what the boss does. So they were wondering, well, do we really need a boss? So you know what they did? They started their own bike shop. And instead of having a boss, they had a collective. And what happened was they were fixing the bikes and they parceled out the nasty jobs and they all took an equal share of the nasty stuff and they all had an equal say in what went on in the bike shop. And they all took home equal profits. And their job satisfaction went from really, really low to really, really high. Their pay didn't change at all. You see? Because it's about being empowered while I'm there, being valued for my opinion, because there's a lot of us in this room that work for people that if you're really honest about it, you're questioning how many brain cells they really have. Hello? Come on. You've questioned if there's two brain cells in there that could get some friction sometimes. And you're going, they're being paid more for me for that. Like, that's just stupid. And they get paid more than me. Like, that's frustrating because I'm smart. And you want to be valued for who you are. And that's the problem in work, is that there's a power imbalance, right? And so this idea then that we deal with, because that's depressing. Hello. That's just downright depressing if you're in a place like that and you're questioning, you know, your boss's intelligence and your value and connection, etc. That's just frustrating. And very real things around loss, around trauma, around work, around life. A buddy of mine said to me a while ago, he said, Tom, I'm really depressed. I said, yeah, I know. And he goes, I said, because your life's depressing. Everything around you is depressing, right? And I said, so let's talk about it. Because that's what we need, is we need connection. Because there is a societal piece around this, where we are collectively part of this together. And I think that's what Ed Sheeran's saying here. That love can change the world. If we were able to take what's in our hand, right? And use it. What's in his hand is a guitar and the song. And that's what he's using. And that's transformational art because it transcends a whole bunch of stuff. And pulls us all in to interface with that idea that love can change the world in a moment. But what do I know? And I love the last line because the last line kind of, for me, wraps it. And where you're going, look, love can change the world, but I don't really know. And you don't know. And that's the difference between being committed to something and being attached to it. Because if I could be committed to loving, but not attached to the outcome. Right? So for how many of you are parents? Okay, perfect. As parents, we all have a wonderful plan for our children's lives. Isn't that right? Now, what's interesting about children is that by the time they hit 16, their job is to leave. Right? Our job is to help them leave. Right? Successful parenting is not having your 32-year-old living in your basement. Okay? Just saying. So it's about helping them leave. Because in that 16 to 19 years, they figure out who are they. Right? And what most teenagers do is they figure out who they are by looking at their parents and going, not me. Right? So they push away from that, and then they're launching, right, into what it is that they want. Now, I remember teaching my children that they were going to go to university. And we're batting about one out of three at the moment. And just completed his first year of university, sitting right over there. So very good. Just wrote his last exam yesterday. So it's very good. And we believe in faith that he actually passed that exam. So that's a good thing. But my two oldest ones, they had heard the university shtick the whole time. I'm an alcoholic, and my youngest daughter, she announces to me when she graduates from high school, she goes, Dad, she's going to take a gap year. I have no idea what that is, but that's what she's taking. And she was taking her bartending license. Okay, if you're an alcoholic and your daughter takes a bartending license, this is not good news. Just saying. Here's the deal. I can't be attached to what they do, but I don't stop loving them and being an amazing dad. Right? Because I am the world's best dad to them. Right? So in that I'm committed to that, but I'm not attached to what happens. Carmen and I work with Wendy up in First Nations. And one of the things we do is we help deal with addiction trauma issues. And somebody's asking me after one of the retreats, they say, well, how many people stay sober? And I said, well, they get sober. It's an opportunity. I said, anecdotally, there's lots of really good stories that we get. I said, I don't really keep a whole bunch of stats on it, to be honest. But love can change the world in a moment. But what do I know? What we do with it is entirely up to them. We cannot wrap ourselves up with the outcomes of what people do with the love that we give. Right? Because if we do that, then it becomes an equation. I will give you money if you're going to do something. Sometimes you give somebody who's a homeless person money and they're going to go buy alcohol with it. And that's okay. It's okay. It's their choice. We can't force people to get sober. We can't force people to do the journey. We can't force people to become Christian. Trust me, we've tried. Right? But we are committed to loving and being loving and then let go of the outcome. So love can change the world. But what do I know? I don't know. Thank you. Go and have an awesome day and give a bunch of people a big hug, even if they're introverted.